Hello and welcome to this special broadcast of the Eugene Symphony on KLCC and KLCC.org. I'm Scott Freck, Executive Director of the Eugene Symphony Association. While we may still be some time away from being able to have concerts at the Holt Center featuring an orchestra in full roar and an audience of several thousand, we still know that music matters. It brings us closer to each other and helps us understand our world and ourselves better. So we're proud to present this third installment of our limited edition program, this time showcasing music from a concert last October 2019. We start with a wildly colorful work by composer Matt Brown, who was born in Burlington, Vermont, and studied music at the University of Colorado and the University of Michigan. Brown is one of four composers selected by Eugene Symphony music director Francesco Lecce-Chong for the First Symphony Project, an ambitious initiative that gives young composers the opportunity to write full-length symphonic works. During the four-year project, each composer visits Eugene twice to teach and engage the community through residency activities and have the orchestra perform not just the new piece, but also one of their previous works. In Matt Brown's case, we heard a piece he wrote in 2014 called Barnstorming Season. In a recent phone call, I asked him where the inspiration for it came from and how it unfolds.
The inspiration for this is sort of much more akin to the type of music I like writing nowadays, is I find some sort of weird historical incident or fact or something that just seems so strange in a story that I am at the same time responding to and also sharing with the audience, like, hey, get a load of this. Barnstorming, which is it's multiple uses for the term, but what the piece is about is this fad in the 1920s where pilots who were flying in World War One who were suddenly out of work would scrounge up whatever money they had and buy army surplus airplanes and then take them to sort of remote farmland in the Midwest so he or she could put on air shows and make a little bit of money. And this was, you know, there was no regulations, there was no oversight to this at all. So people would do it wherever they wanted, and they would obviously compete with each other during the barnstorming season, is the summer months where they would do this most often.
Yeah.
And as I said, there were no regulations, and they needed to compete to be the more interesting group. So they would do progressively more and more dangerous and thrilling stunts to the point where people would jump from one plane to the other in midair, fly in the air and then climb out and change their tire while still in the air, and all of these just completely batty things that I can't believe were actually done. And that's where the idea from the piece came from, is like being someone, you know, who lived in rural, I don't know, Iowa, Indiana, someplace in the Midwest, who maybe you haven't seen too many airplanes. And now you're not only seeing this incredible feat of machinery and engineering, but these human beings doing these just outrageously dangerous stunts must have been, in one way, thrilling, and in another way, just completely terrifying. And that dichotomy is sort of where the piece gets its gusto from, is all of this constant shifting of tension from, you know, goofy hilarity to sort of jarring and dissonant terror, and all of these things to tell this story, try to get in the mind of what one of those people would be thinking.
Hmm. So what are some ways you capture those feelings in the music?
Well, I think in general, it's playing around with expectations is the biggest thing, where I try to lead the listener in a certain direction and sort of undercutting them whenever I think it's the most is the most effective time. So, for instance, the piece, as you'll hear, will begin with sort of my musical depiction of an airplane starting up. You'll hear the propellers start and the engine roar, and then you'll hear them take off the airplane, fly into the sky. And then the moment that they do their first stunt, where the terror has sort of ratcheted up to a certain point, I won't ruin the surprise for you, but I go in a completely opposite direction from what you might be thinking. And from then on, I'll just completely pull the rug out under from the listener over and over again, taking different styles of music and taking different quotations from other composers and layering them on top of each other and just sort of creating this chaotic, terrifying, hilarious sound mass that sort of brings in this chaotic story in all sorts of different sonic ways.
Hmm. And for me, Matt, there's a moment toward the end of the piece when it feels like we sort of burst above the cloud layer into a really brilliant, bright blue sky. And it's just such a spectacular moment after all of the chaos that comes before. Tell me about that moment.
Yeah, and that's sort of, you know, as a storyteller, you think, well, you have the beginning, you have the middle, but, like, you can't just end in more chaos. You can't do what you already done before. You need to constantly push the expectations of the listener, and what better way to thwart those expectations than after having this chaotic, terrifying mess for 4 to 5 minutes, finally give them something grandiose and something wonderful to grab onto, giving them the impression that things are fine, things are okay, they know what they're doing, and this is just an amazing moment to witness. But then, as you'll hear, that I undercut the expectations one or two more times even after that moment.
That's composer Matt Brown talking about his piece called Barnstorming Season. Now let's hear it in its entirety in this performance by the Eugene Symphony. Music director and conductor Francesco Lecce Chong led the orchestra in concert on Thursday, October 17th, 2019, at the Holt Center for the Performing Arts. Music of Matt Brown. Thank you. That was Barnstorming Season by American composer Matt Brown, performed by the Eugene Symphony in a concert led by Francesco Lecce Chong on October 17, 2019. The piece was inspired by traveling air shows that barnstormed around the country in the 1920s. And if you thought you heard a few fragments of ragtime in it, you were right. Next up, we'll hear two movements from Gustav Mahler's Symphony No. 1 in D major. Today, we remember Gustav Mahler primarily for his 9 completed symphonies and other large-scale orchestral works, but during his lifetime, he was most famous as a conductor. He got his first job in 1880 at the age of 20, and then held posts in places like Prague, Budapest, and Hamburg, before ascending the heights of the conducting world as music director of the Vienna Court Opera and briefly the Metropolitan Opera and New York Philharmonic before his death at the age of 51 in 1911. But much as he was certainly an accomplished interpreter of Mozart and Beethoven, it's his own music that endures more than a century later. He remarked to fellow composer Jan Sibelius when the two met in Helsinki, Finland in 1907 that, quote, "A symphony must be like the world. It must embrace everything." I asked Eugene Symphony's music director and conductor Francesco Lecce Chong what Mahler meant by that and how that concept comes through in his music.
So I think Mahler had this conception of music really representing what it means to live. And while it wasn't entirely unique at the beginning of the 20th century, no composer had really taken it to this level. When we think about the music of daily life, it would have been like Mozart's folk dances and some of his Turkish-inspired music and composers writing like maybe little dance pieces or something using like gypsy melodies or, you know, something like this. And that was kind of the extent of having so-called concert music reflect the music of daily life. And what Mahler did so spectacularly well that at first confused his audience, but still made them flock again and again to hear these magnificent symphonies he was writing, is that the scope of these symphonies was deeper. And it somehow had this gravitas to it that made people pay attention. And yet we see it right from this first symphony. It's full of the music of Mahler's life. You know, growing up in a town that had a military outpost. So you have fanfares, you have, you know, brass fanfares, trumpet fanfares in the distance. You have klezmer bands playing on the street. You have the Lendlers, the beautiful Viennese waltzes. It's all the music that people lived their life to. And at first it turned off people because they went to the concert hall in many ways, they thought, to kind of have this holy experience and be kind of and kind of leave all of their daily life behind. And I think the true spectacular nature of Mahler is that he pulled everything together, both the transcendent quality of music and especially orchestral music and of this long form symphony, but he brought it down to earth and connected it with the music of people's lives. And that in its essence is how Mahler, I think, better than any other composer perhaps we've ever had, turned the symphony into something that represents what it means to live and to have it represent the world.
So for this program, we're going to hear the middle two movements. How does this idea show up in movement two and movement three?
I think it's especially prominent in these two movements. I think especially the third movement is perhaps most legendary for showing off this idea of the music of daily life. But, you know, in the second movement, it's this rough and gruff dance is kind of the main theme that you get out of this. And I always kind of add an extra quality to this, which I got from one of my great mentors, Manfred Honeck. He does something that's not marked at the beginning of the second movement. It's so incredibly effective that I couldn't help but kind of try my own version of it, which is having the cellos and basses. Normally, they would just kind of start with this, you know, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3. But you actually, like, started off really slow and heavy and very raw. And you have them doing all these down bows, so they're literally just digging into their instruments. And you kind of hear this dance kind of wind up and get started. And it's so incredibly exciting. And then the contrasting section is perhaps one of my favorite moments in the symphony, where you have this just gorgeous Viennese waltz. Mahler was so in touch with the waltz king, Johann Strauss Jr., and all these famous delicate Viennese waltzes, and he just lays this one right in the middle of this rough folk dance, and it is just breathtaking how beautiful it is. Lots of rubato, like he really asks for the orchestra to have this flexibility with time, and it just, it's kind of the perfect center that you need of the second movement. In the third movement, this is very famous because we have the children's tune Frère Jacques, and except it's set in a minor key, and it starts off in the double bass. It's a double bass solo, a double bass and accompanied by timpani, which I'm pretty sure this is the only duet for double bass and timpani that we have in the repertoire.
Yeah, I think so.
And, you know, it already is one of the spookiest things you're going to hear, because how often do we get to hear a double bass player playing solo? Then how often do we get to hear that bass player playing pretty high up on their instrument? And so this melody that's already a weird, twisted version of this children's tune is in an instrument that makes it sound like a ghost. And Mahler's whole conception around this was, it's very much black comedy. You know, it's a funeral march, is what he's doing. And set to this children's tune, but it's sarcastic. There's some edges to it. And in fact, you know, one of the moments in this symphony that sticks out so much is when the so-called kind of klezmer band basically kind of, it would be visually as if they walked right through this funeral procession. And so even as the Frère Jacques is going along, you suddenly have this like kind of kind of like this happy band come and just kind of walk right through the mess of it, and then fades away, and then we're still back in the original Frère Jacques theme. It's just one of, I don't even know how a composer could conceive of something so brilliant. And I think it's just because the visual that Mahler had in his head of this procession that is both sad but funny and odd, and it all comes together in this third movement. It's unlike anything else, and that's where you start to see that this first symphony was really Mahler throwing down the gauntlet and saying, I'm going to do something that no other composer has done, and when I'm finished, the symphony will never be the same.
That's Eugene Symphony's music director Francesco Lecce-Chong talking about Gustav Mahler's Symphony No. 1 in D major. Now here's Francesco leading the Eugene Symphony in two movements from it. First up is Movement 2, marked in German as Kräftig bewegt, or in English, moving strongly, followed by Movement 3, Feierlich und gemessen, or solemnly and measured, music of Gustav Mahler.
Thank you.
the middle two movements of Gustav Mahler's Symphony No. 1 in D major in this performance by the Eugene Symphony from October 2019, led by Francesco Lecce-Chang. Next up, we'll hear the final movement of Felix Mendelssohn's Concerto for Two Pianos and Orchestra, featuring twin sisters Christina and Michelle Naughton. You're listening to a special broadcast of the Eugene Symphony on KLCC and KLCC.org. I'm Scott Freck. Felix Mendelssohn has to rank up there with Wolfgang Amadeus Mozart among music's great wunderkinds, and it's probably a good thing that they were both early bloomers, as neither lived past their mid-30s. Mendelssohn was born in Hamburg, Germany in 1809, about 18 years after Mozart had died. He showed early aptitude as a pianist, and by age 12 was writing his own music. Two of his best-loved pieces, an octet for strings and the overture to A Midsummer Night's Dream, were written by the time he was 17. The work we hear today is even earlier than that. Young Felix was just 14 in 1823 when he wrote this concerto for two pianos for himself and his older sister Fanny to play together. To perform it, we have another pair of siblings, identical twin sisters Christina and Michelle Naughton. They were born in Princeton, New Jersey, and studied music at the Juilliard School in New York and the Curtis Institute in Philadelphia. In a recent phone conversation, I asked them if knowing that Mendelssohn wrote this piece to play with his sister might make it more meaningful for them to perform it, and whether that shows up in the music at all.
Oh, I think definitely. I can definitely feel there's some kind of, like, sibling relation. A lot of it, there are parts both where you have to play things pretty much with one voice together, and then there's also places with healthy competition with, like, some sibling rivalry in there for sure. And he's very young as well when he wrote this, so it's full of, like, youthful energy.
Can you give us some examples of where you have to be as one voice and then times when you have to have that rivalry thing?
Oh, the third movement is full of that, especially the coda. It's very fun, but, and I mean, the funny thing about it is that it's very different than, like, a synchronized sport. We don't actually think per se about, like, lining things up. And in fact, it's actually okay even if it isn't perfectly that way. It's supposed to mimic life in a way, and that it's like having a conversation, and it's like when you start conversing with someone and people start naturally kind of like mirroring each other when they're completely in tune with each other. So it's not something that you have to be like, oh my gosh, we've got to be one nanosecond. Yeah, you know, one nanosecond off is too much, right? It's not quite like that. But it's more of a feeling and kind of a bond that you have with another player that's both spontaneous, and with the orchestra, I think there is that extra layer, especially with this particular piece too. The energy is kind of goes full circle with the orchestra, the players, and the audience. It's somehow a very interactive atmosphere, I feel, in this piece.
Yeah, so describe a little bit, since we're going to hear the third movement, describe the character of this for the two of you. And if this isn't the most unfair question, I don't know what it is, but who has the best part between the two of you?
Oh, man. Oh, that's really hard. I mean, I would say the character is extremely exuberant and lively and very playful, I would say, most of the time. And there's also some lyrical melodies interspersed throughout the piece, right? And, you know, your part kind of starts with that, and then, you know, mine kind of scampers along in response to those lyrical passages. And then I think as the movement goes on, it kind of melds so that we both kind of end with this spirited coda that I just referred to. So it's like it kind of the two pianos start on, you know, either end, and then we kind of, as we converse, come together at the end. That's the magic of this movement.
That's twin sisters Christina and Michelle Naughton talking about Felix Mendelssohn's Concerto for Two Pianos and Orchestra in E major. Now let's hear the last of its three movements marked Allegro, the music of Felix Mendelssohn.
Thank you.
the final movement of Felix Mendelssohn's Concerto for Two Pianos and Orchestra in E Major, in a performance by Christina and Michelle Naughton on October 17, 2019. Francesco Lecce-Chong led the Eugene Symphony in concert at the Holt Center for the Performing Arts in Eugene, Oregon. Following the Mendelssohn Concerto, the Naughton sisters returned to the stage to play an encore. Malagueña by Cuban composer Ernesto Lecuona, in a version for two pianos performed by twin sisters Michelle and Christina Naughton. The pair played it as an encore following Felix Mendelssohn's Concerto for Two Pianos and Orchestra with the Eugene Symphony. Earlier in the program, we also heard two movements of Gustav Mahler's Symphony No. 1 and Matt Brown's Barnstorming Season. This broadcast was sponsored in part by Farmers Union Coffee Roasters. The Eugene Symphony would also like to thank the Haugland Family Foundation, which sponsored the concert in October 2019, and Oakmont Family Dental, which was guest artist sponsor for piano soloists Christina and Michelle Naughton. Special thanks to the musicians of the Eugene Symphony and Local 689 of the American Federation of Musicians. The concert was recorded by Bill Barnett of Gung Ho Studios. This has been a special broadcast of the Eugene Symphony in partnership with KLCC-FM, NPR for Oregonians, in downtown Eugene. I'm Scott Freck, Executive Director of the Eugene Symphony Association, and I also wrote, edited, and produced this program. We hope to see you at the Holt Center or out in the community soon, and thank you for listening.